diversity. What is the justification for presenting the culture and the aesthetic theory of the Frankfurt School under assembly heading? First, all of our theorists shared more or less the same theory of social formations, that is, theory of culture in the general sense, inherited from Hegel, Marx, Tönnies, Weber, and Lukács. Second, the aesthetic alternatives in the era of culture in the narrow sense, they developed in response to this theory of social formations, matured in the context of dialogue, characterized by the mutual and complementary adequacy of their critiques of one another. Theory of social formations. Under his heading, we have in mind the historical specification of the formation of civil society, or, more narrowly, capitalism, by the epoch-making investigations of Hegel, Marx, Weber, Tönnies, and Lukács. Here we can focus only on some of these theorists and such as their concepts as pertain to the Frankfurt critique of culture in the narrow sense. The system that Hegel called bürgerliche, civil or bourgeois Gesellschaft, society, was located by Marx, especially in the 1867 Grundrisse der Kritik der politischen Ökonomie. In an imposing framework of historical social formations, Marx called this framework one of organic, naturally arisen, naturwüchsig communities, that is, the pre-capitalist social formations. What is common to all three great forms of organic communities, Asiatic, classical antiquity, and Germanic, is direct personal dependence of human beings on natural land and quasi-natural, the community itself, presuppositions of existence, footnote 14, text. So individuality, the presupposition of which is some private property, is mentioned by Marx in the case of classical Greece and Rome. He stresses that even here individuality can operate only within restricted and provincial communal limits. Footnote 15, text, page 190. Hegel's civil society, founded on more independent individuality, is located by Marx, in spite of all earlier anticipations, only after the end of the European Middle Ages. Fully unfolded as capitalism, this system of the socialization of society, Vergesellschaftung der Gesellschaft, is abstractly characterized as that of personal independence founded on objective dependence, in which a system of general social metabolism, of universal relations, of all-round needs and universal capacities, is formed for the first time. Footnote 16, text. Evidently, Marx's attitude to the capitalist social formation was profoundly ambiguous, and he was willing to declare it as progress only if a third great stage of history, based on free individuality and the subordination of wealth to a new, freely formed community, were realized. Footnote 17, text. It is, however, a characteristic of capitalism that all substantial communities disintegrate under the onslaught of market, competition, and large-scale industrial division of labor, forcing the subordination of the newly freed individuals to a new system of mechanically objective dependence. For example, economic laws of the market and production. Furthermore, the new dependence and interdependence of individuals is not only regulated by objective laws, but is also masked by the system of exchange of things, that is, commodities. Domination and the exploitation of labor becomes anonymous when the social connections of persons is transposed into a social relation between things. Here is the origin of Marx's concept of commodity fetishism. Marx stresses that the resulting objective context, which is deterministic laws, tendentially reduces the newly emancipated individual to an abstract individual, emptied of all formerly internalized communal norms, customs, and habits. The birth and decline of the individual are thus located by Marx in the same social order, which becomes the proper historical terrain of Simmel's trans-historical tragedy of culture. For Marx, in contradistinction to Simmel, the socialization of society represented the objective possibility of a new social individuality, a possibility that could be realized only through radical social transformation. It should be stressed that Marx did not consider the creation of national communities, as in the French Revolution, to be identical with this social transformation. The continued existence of a state, an illusory community, separate from civil society, reveals the non-communal nature of the realm of social reproduction. Marx's historical theory of social formations, worked out in the Grundrisse, became available only after World War II. Nevertheless, theorists like Tönnies, stressing the movement from community, Gemeinschaft, to society, Gesellschaft, as the backbone of modern history, and Lukács, were able to piece much of it together from the deliberately non-historical volumes of Das Kapital, where Marxists attempted to work out the systematic nature and general tendency of capitalism. Page 191. Lukács, in his context, was able to utilize the work of his older friend Max Weber. The Frankfurt theorists in turn projected their version of Marxian historical sociology through the conceptual spectacles of Weber and Lukács. Max Weber's question, footnote 18, text, about the specificity of modernity is complementary to that of Marx. Though not the Marx whose works Weber knew, even if the respective methodologies were entirely different. Weber's answers in terms of concepts like rationalization, bureaucratization, and the demagicization fill in crucial aspects of what Marx outlined as the socialization of society under industrial capitalism. Weber's depiction of the imprisonment of the individual in the iron cage of modernity is the point on which Marx and he were in full agreement, except that Marx also envisioned a post-capitalist liberation of the individual that would not abolish the material gains of capitalism. Weber's key concepts provide the cultural and political context of the iron cage that Marx largely neglected, and at the same time they challenge the plausibility of Marx's post-capitalist visions. It was to be the unsolved task of Lukács and all of critical Marxism to use Weber against Marxist orthodoxy, and yet to move beyond Weber in the spirit of Marx. Let us examine Weber's key categories of rationalization in demagicization, Entzauberung, usually translated as disenchantment, footnote 19, text. Rationalization for Weber, the key to all modernization and industrialization, represents the historical, originally under capitalism, penetration of all spheres of social life. the economy, culture, art, religion and science, technology, law and politics, and everyday life by a single logic of formal rationality. This logic is defined by the principle of orientation of human action to abstract, quantifiable, and calculable, and instrumentally utilizable formal rules and norms. The key to formal rationality is the phrase, without regard for persons, which was first expressed in its purity in the battle of early modern science against anthropomorphic nature philosophy. In a more general form, the de-anthropomorphizing tendency of rationalization is expressed by Weber's concept of Entzauberung or de-magicization, the elimination of all that is unpredictable, irrational, qualitative, sensuous, and mysterious from both theoretical explanation and the practical conduct of life. Page 192. Weber always refused to present rationalization as the self-unfolding logic of history. Footnote 20, text. Furthermore, he made neither the historically prior rise of science, as did 19th century positivism, nor the historically late emergence of industrial capitalism, as did the Marxists, the cause of the essence or the telos of rationalization, formal rationality and or de-magicization are first of all present in the most diverse historical settings and contexts. Roman law could rise to a higher degree of formal systemization than the English common law of the period of the Industrial Revolution. Biblical Jewish theology, based on monotheism and the prohibition of images, was more disenchanted than all forms of Christianity until at least Calvinism. Partly rational bureaucracies existed in China thousands of years before modernization in the West, nor were the particular logics of these rational spheres identical except on the highest level of abstraction. The question is, why were the somewhat heterogeneous and relatively underdeveloped spheres of formal reasons combined together only in Western Europe? The elective affinity of the spheres of commercial capitalism, early nation state, early modern science, Roman law, and so on. That is, the abstract presence in all of some mode of the same formal rationality was a necessary but not yet sufficient condition. The formal rationality, and especially the calculability of one sphere, is of course directly enhanced when combined with that of another, or the others. But to Weber, even this explanation smacked of unacceptable teleology. His own explanation, one that he never considered more than the best alternative hypothesis, was that a process of rationalization was blocked everywhere by the survival of traditional, quasi-magical, irrational elements with the economic ethics of world religions. Everywhere except in the context of the inner worldly ascetic ethics of Protestantism. Without the irrationally motivated, footnote 21, text, yet staunchly rationalistic ethics of Calvinism and Puritanism in particular, the hallmark of Western modernity, the rational organization of free labor based on saving and work discipline, could never have been attained. Weber's thesis on the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism rejoins the context depicted by Marx as the socialization of society, by Tönnies as the movement from community to society, and by Simmel, ahistorically, as the general